There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com. Book of the Week, what you should be reading.
So our Book of the Week this week is Still Me by Jojo Moyes. It is the follow-up to Me Before You, the first in the series, and After You, the second in the series. And it's not out until the end of January next year. So we're very lucky to have got our hands on it and be reviewing it with Flora Reese, who is head of education, training and publishing. Oh man, I didn't get it 100% right.
Very nearly.
So a little bit about Still Me, if you want to know more, if you're fans of the trilogy, or even if you're not fans of the trilogy, we're going to try very hard not to give any spoilers away, so bear with us. So Louisa Clark arrives in New York ready to start a new life, confident that she can embrace this new adventure and keep her relationship with Ambulance Sam, I love that little nickname, Ambulance Sam, alive across several thousand miles. She's thrown into the world of the super rich Gopniks, Leonard and his much younger second wife, Agnes, and a never-ending array of household staff and hangers-on. Lou is determined to get the most out of the experience and throws herself into her job, a New York life within this privileged world. So the first question, I'm actually not going to go to you, Flora. I'm going to go to Jonathan, because this is part of a series, the, you know, Louisa Clark, or I like to call it the Bumblebee Tights trilogy, basically, because her Bumblebee Tights are iconic. Did you find it easy to get into this, or did you feel like you were missing bits because you hadn't read books one and two? Because I want to establish for listeners whether they can go out and get this in January if they haven't read the first two.
Absolutely. I found no trouble whatsoever getting stuck into this, and I felt that I was missing absolutely nothing. I think it's very cleverly written, that you don't have to have read the first two to read this on its own and to enjoy it. I certainly, having read it, started doing a bit of research and reading what had happened in the other books and learning a bit more about the character, and then it made more sense, but it works on its own.
Flora, what did you think of the book overall? Did you enjoy it?
I really enjoyed it. I've read both the other two and love them, so it was great to get back into the same world and sort of meet Lou again and find out what she's up to.
Who would you recommend Me Before You, After You, the Bumblebee Tights trilogy to?
The Bumblebee Tights trilogy. It's good commercial fiction, but it's got some real themes and meanings, and I think it's a great book for, I mean, I love that Jonathan's loved it as much, because we tend to categorise things as women's fiction, but
absolutely,
I don't think that's
fair.
I think this has much more to it and can be read by anybody.
It's not just for women?
No,
absolutely not. One thing I did want to talk about on that subject was the first book, Me Before You. I remember picking that book up, I think I was given it as a leaving gift for something, and the cover definitely doesn't do the book justice, and I found this quite a few times with commercial fiction, or what people like to call chick lit, which really annoys me. And the story itself is actually really rich and engaging, and then they've put this really silly, fluffy cover on it, and that really frustrates me. Like, from a publishing point of view, who makes these decisions?
It is decided in the publishing house. I mean, the book will be briefed by the editor, and the arts department will work on it, and it will go to the author as well. I think it's a really difficult one, covers. I mean, it's one of the most important things about the book.
Yeah.
You see the first thing that you see about the book, and people make a lot of decisions based on that. And it's a really careful balance between making it a wide enough market that lots of people who might enjoy the book will pick it up, as well as capturing the people, you know, who you know will enjoy the book. And I think, particularly when the first one came out, there was still a lot of the women's fiction, as there still is, riding high in the charts, and there were particular styles that were used. And I think, you know, tying into that market is also really important. You have to look at what is out there, what is working, what's selling, and what readers are going to identify as something they're going to want to read. So all that ties in to making the cover. If you look at what the biggest market for the book is, the biggest market probably will be women. But what you want to do is not lose your main market while still trying to entice the wider market in to read the book. I think that's possibly what was the case with hers.
Is this a dynamic between the literature itself, just the pure words, and the marketing that goes behind it to sell it?
Yes. I think the key thing, it's interesting you said that the cover didn't work for you as really representing what's in the book, and that isn't a worrying thing before publishers, because obviously you don't want to be misrepresenting anything to readers, but clearly you love the book, so it didn't ultimately matter.
No.
And there will be people who picked up the book because of the cover and wouldn't have picked it up if it was a different cover and therefore also loved it. It's a difficult balancing act to make.
This is, our listeners can't see this, but this is a fairly, not to say bland, but it's a fairly neutral cover. There is a little nod, I feel, to people who know the stories in, yeah. in the form of a very small bumblebee in one corner. Mm. Otherwise, it's just text, albeit artfully laid out and quite engaging.
It could be, though, what we have here is the advance proof, so we don't know what whether the cover will be this or whether there'll be something different.
I've had a quick look and they all look rather nice, actually. Yeah. I want to talk a little bit beyond the cover now and just go into some of the characters that we get to meet, because I think a big joy, not only is Louisa Clark the protagonist that we know and love, but the people that she interacts with. So we know Ambulance Sam already. Who are the new people that we're introduced to in this book?
So we're introduced to the people that Louisa's working for. And this is really interesting, because back in the first book, she was working for the trainers, who are a very quite stilted, quite upper-class family that she found quite difficult to interact with at first. And now she's kind of thrown into almost a New York equivalent, a millionaire and his family living this incredibly plush penthouse on Fifth Avenue. And she is very much stuff. And so she interacts with Mr. Gropnik, who is the millionaire, and his new wife, Agnes, who is a very interesting, very difficult, very complicated character, trying to herself work out where she stands within this new world that she's married into. I love that we get back to Nathan again, who's a physiotherapist. In the first book, it's lovely to have him back in the book again. And then one of the characters I absolutely loved was one of the neighbours around the corner, who Louise develops a interesting relationship with as well.
Mrs. DeWitt
and her dog Dean Martin.
Great name for a dog.
I agree with that. I thought the dynamic between Agnes and Louisa was one of the most interesting in the books, because they are both outsiders coming to this family, and there's also, as well as them both being similar in that regard, they have this difference in that one is the employee of the other, but also that line is blurred sometimes.
I think it is, and I think it's really interesting. I mean, Lou is such an engaging character. She always has been throughout all the books. She's very, you know, even when she's doing something stupid, you can empathise with it, because you can see how she's getting herself into the situation she does. And there's some great set pieces in the book, and there's some great, you know, funny laugh-out moments right from the very beginning when she's arriving in the US and talking far too much to border control. Mm. And I think she's sort of really good-hearted and open, and allows her to, that does allow sort of the lines to be blurred. And you can see where the dynamics are going to, and the tensions are going to come out, because she's so friendly that she isn't always going to realise where her place ends and where she may or may not get the friendship that she feels is being proffered.
I think the fact that she's an employee but the lines are often blurred is an interesting thing to bring up, because yes, she's an employee of the Gopniks, but her job is quite odd in a way. She's an assistant technically to Agnes, Leonard Gopnik's second and much younger wife. But she's also meant to be more of a friend, a companion and a support. What is it that Agnes needs her for?
Well, she's kind of been hired to keep Agnes happy, is what comes through, to make her life easier and to help with this sort of transition into a world where she's replaced somebody else. Agnes has replaced a first wife who is obviously much highly valued within New York society, which is something Louisa at first just doesn't understand how it all works. Engaged with charity dinners and all the different elements of society where you have to be very much on show. And this is obviously something that Agnes finds very difficult. And Louisa's role is to try and make it easier for her.
And what's Louisa's journey in all of this? I mean, is she's not 100% sure of herself. She's still finding her feet, isn't she?
Oh, I think it's really interesting following the three books through, because obviously the first one, The experiences of the first one, of the first book, Me Before You, at the very end of that, after what happens in the first book, she's coming crashing down after initially finding her feet and finding her way forward and thinking that she's found a positive and a way forward after the tragedy of the first one. And then during the book, she comes crashing down quite literally, and that leads to a whole new set of consequences for her. And then so in the third book, she's kind of out of that real deep difficulty, but she still doesn't really know who she is. She's still giving to everybody else and not really working out who she wants to be and what she wants to do for herself. And that's what this book is about?
We spoke a minute ago about painting a picture, and that's something that struck a chord with me. I think it's something that Jojo Moyes does extremely well, and it's one of the things I like the most about this book, how much I could visualize what was happening right from, as you say, the opening page, where Lou is speaking to a customs official at JFK Airport, and giving too much of herself away. And you can see the sort of clash of the two personalities, or the clash in that particular situation. How does the writer do that? How does she make it so visual?
I think she has this great ability to show what's going on. The way that she writes is visual. I think she puts us very much in Lou's own head. That's where we're seeing the story from. And so she has a very bright outlook on the world. And so that's where these contrasts come in, where Lou is seeing other people, you know, responding to her openness and her honesty. I mean, I think it ties in also with the way that New York, when we first arrive, Jojo Moyes shows us this kind of she's like almost like a startled rabbit going around New York trying to work out how it works. And you gradually don't even realise that along with Lou, as a reader, you become acquainted with the city. You suddenly feel like you know where you are. You stop and you think, yes, I understand New York now. I'm feeling it with her. So that's a real talent of Jojo Moyes, to be able to show that background atmosphere, that background vision and imagery in her writing.
And I think she's also extremely good at picking out one or two characteristics of people and using them to exemplify their type. They're sort of almost sort of stock characters. So again, on that first page, the customs official, she zeroes in on his moustache, and that's what the first paragraph in the book is about. And somehow that's such a key attribute that you can imagine the customs official. Likewise with the personal trainer, whose name I can't remember, but she gives away a couple of characteristics about him, which enables the reader to see him.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. She's very good at very quickly creating a character through visual cues, which allow you just to work straight from it and feel that picture in your head of who they are.
Book of the Week, what you should be reading.
We are just back with some final thoughts on Still Me by Jojo Moyes, which is the follow-up to Me Before You and After You. Still Me is not out until the end of January 2018, so we're really lucky to be reviewing it in the studio with Flora. Flora, before we finish up with this, I just want to ask you one final question, get some final thoughts from you. By going back to the beginning, the very beginning, Still Me, the title of the book on the front cover, what does that mean in the context of the whole?
I think it's about Lou herself and what her inner concept of herself, and everything that's happened to her over these three books, the course of the last couple of years that have taken place, and the inner core of her understanding of her own self and what she needs to retain of her own confidence, her own sense of self. And this is very much about finding out who you want to be away from the people who also define you, because being part of people who love you, her family, so it is really important, but she needs to get away from that and work out what it is that she wants herself.
I love that, finding out who you want to be away from the people who define you. I think that's a lovely way to end our discussion about Still Me by Jojo Moyes. Now, unfortunately, it's not a brilliant thing for us to recommend to you today, because, you know, if you're looking for last minute gift ideas, it's not out until January, but hopefully we can fix that and we can make up for it, because Flora's also here because she's going to talk to us about some gifts that you can get the writers in your lives, because, you know, writers, Jonathan, you're a writer.
Of sorts.
I'm going to put you on the
text
spot
messages,
now.
Twitter. Prolific.
Well, I just thought it would be nice to talk about, you know, books that can help you improve your writing. And the first thing that I know that you want to talk about is something called Into the Woods. And I'm very intrigued by this. Tell us more.
Well, there's a lot of books about writing, how to write, how to structure your books, how to write narrative, how to write dialogue, and so on. And I do think, just going very briefly back, that it's a lovely idea, because writers often are writing quite solitary, they can be a little bit secretive about writing, and actually supporting the writer in your life by giving them a gift that would be helpful, I think is a really lovely idea for the festive season. So what I Into the Woods is a book about why stories work, and so it's not a manual specifically for this is how to structure a paragraph, this is how to structure a novel. John York is a writer himself. He has written TV scripts, screenplays, and so on. And he sat down to try and work out what it is about structure and why stories work, because all these famous books on writing, which a few of them I'll bring up in a bit, they just say how to do it rather than why we do it. And the fact is that stories tend to come back to a single unifying form. And this is a really intriguing question, is why? Why we as humans have this great need to tell stories? And when we do tell stories, they have a structure, mm-hmm. whether you mean to or not. And one of the really lovely points in his book is that even the writers who very much want to break the mold and move away from this idea of particular ways of writing, when you break down what they write, generally they still have this structure, because without it, stories don't quite work. So Into the Woods is, I think it's great. It's a fascinating read, from the difference between five-act and three-act structures, the way stories come back to this essential form, whether we want them to or not. He has some great plot breakdowns.
And who's the author again?
Some serious graphics. It's John York, and it's called Into the Woods.
Okay, so this is for stories in general, or is it more specifically? The reason I ask this is that I'm in the midst of writing a radio play. Would it work for that?
Yes, I think it would. If you're interested in why stories work and getting some idea of structure, he does interestingly say that you don't need to understand it, but you will generally have an unconscious ability on how to shape a structure, and this is giving you an idea of why structure exists. But I think you would find it very interesting. I think it is useful for a screenplay or a playwright in your life, and people who are interested in writing. I mean, along with this, another one is the classic Robert McKee book on it's called Story, Style, Structure, Substance and the Principle of Screenwriting, which is a very confident direct guide to elements of story and principles of story design, which is something that if you're wanting some specific direction, mm-hmm. you might find very interesting. He covers problems faced in writing, a host of other issues, and he's passionate about how to write a good story that's well told. So it doesn't do quite the why of Into the Woods, but sometimes starting with something very clear can help you boil down the essence of how you want to write. And interestingly, last year a new follow-up book called Dialogue came out. So if that's something that you're interested in, that can be a very useful one.
What does that mean, that it's well told? Because I always imagine, as someone involved in theatre, that having something that's well told is about how it's delivered, as in by the actor or the reader. But what does it mean in the context of something that's written?
In the context of this, it's about ensuring, and this is the difficult point, because we have these structures in place. We know that there are structures to story. There's a way that narrative arc follows. But if you slavishly follow that without looking at what you're actually writing, your story won't be satisfying as a whole. So it's understanding the craft of writing and then using that as you want in your own story.
And when you say structures, just to boil it down a little bit more, I mean, are we talking about beginning, middle, end, or is it something a bit more complex than that?
Well, it starts with beginning, middle, end, and then it works into the main plot points and how a story is structured, what point you need to hit for a story to be satisfying to the reader when they get to the end of it, or to the playwright, for the play audience. And I mean, if you're a new writer, I know this has been covered recently by Brandy Scott, the absolute classic is On Writing by Stephen King, mm-hmm. Which has real insights on writing that's sort of shot through with autobiography. And it's really entertaining, it's useful, and it's very truthful. It's great on the writer-reader relationship. The chapter, What Writing Is, the first line is telepathy, the idea being that what a writer is writing is going to make pictures in the head of the reader. And that is an extraordinary thing to do. They're not going to be identical, but he is creating that. Another one that can help with this essence of craft and storytelling for novels, I think also would be effective for other types of writing, is someone who's recommended me recently, which is Nancy Lamb's The Art and Craft of Storytelling. So it does what it says on the tin. It's about the importance of mastering the craft and what this means. And she would say good story flows from a solid understanding of style and structure, along with a confident grasp of character, plot and dialogue. Once you've mastered that, you follow the rules, break the rules or create new ones, but you'll always have a basic foundation to support you. So that's a good one for a new writer as well.
Stephen King's concept of telepathy there struck a bit of a chord, because I often feel that the main challenge that writers and a lot of artists face is writing something that other people want to read. So mm-hmm. that there's clearly a spectrum here, and at one end you have an artist or a writer who is writing something for themselves 100%. It's their story. They don't consider who their audience might be, and if they get lucky, they get lucky, but it will be lucky. And if they're not successful, then it may be because of that point. And at the other end of the spectrum, you have a writer or an artist who is producing work that is only for their audience, and in that sense it becomes mass-produced and formulaic. So that is an interesting perspective from Stephen King, because it suggests that you have to be somewhere in the middle of the spectrum.
Yeah, possibly, yes. I think the point of all these books is so that you have the tools that you need in order to put the story together. What you then do with it is you know, your theme, your genre, the way that you want to write, is the decision the author's got to make. A lot of, you know, the sort of, as you say, the very, very commercial fiction is often looked down on by some people because they think it's just been put together purely, you know, commercially. And yet it's very satisfying to a large number of readers. And, you know, we believe that reading is a good thing. And if you're reading, you're reading, and that's fantastic.
Mm.
So, but I think with these particular books on storytelling, another one I really like is Lawrence Block. He does very good on structure. His book, he's updated it for the digital age. It's now called Writing the Novel from Plot to Print to Pixel.
Mm-hmm.
Very straightforward, open description storytelling. But with him, he points out what works for him and what might work for you without being in any way directive about this is what you have to do, this is what you must do. I think, you know, I like the way he tells it. He's got good insight on digital and self-publishing. So you've got an author who's looking for getting themselves published. That's an interesting one too.
Do you? I mean, if you didn't know how to write a story or you didn't know anything about the craft of it, could you not just come and sit down and write something? I think it's quite tempting to think that that's how it happens. Writers sit at desks and out pops a novel. Does that ever happen?
I think it does. And I think what's interesting about Into the Woods, going back to that one, is... we all have the ability to tell a story. And if you ask a child to tell a story, they will essentially tell a story without any training that ties into this essential story structure where you have an opening, you have a midpoint where things change, and you have an ending and a resolution. So we all have an innate ability to do it. I think that you don't need to study story writing specifically, but you will often find that when you finish a novel and it doesn't quite work, if you go back and look at how the structure is working, you can find the problem. And you can fix it if you have an idea of the craft of storytelling.
That you mentioned tools earlier, and that brings me to a question that I've been meaning to ask. And that's, for this segment, you know, is there a one-size-fits-all book for every kind of writer? Or are people going to have to do a little bit of shopping around? And also, can we be too fussy about having the right tools?
Definitely we can be too fussy. I mean, the basic thing about writing is sit down and write.
Exactly.
Just start. And don't be scared of a blank page. Just write something, anything, because it can be edited later. Just start writing. And in Bird by Bird by Anne Lamott, she does a lovely chapter on that. That's a book I think Brandi Scott talked about a month or so ago. And I think that's a really interesting one. It's like Stephen King's. It's an autobiographical note detailing her own frustrations and her confidence lapses. But it takes us through from getting started through writer's block, through the problems of writing the next book if you do get published. And it's always honest. I mean, she says we write to expose the unexposed. And it's having something to say is also important.
So me saying that I can't write my great big novel that I have inside me until I have a typewriter and feel like Truman Capote is complete nonsense.
It's kind of procrastination.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry. But if you the thing is to find the time, to find the space and sit down and actually just get the words on the page. And then you can find out whether you've got the confidence, the momentum to carry you through.
I think a deadline helps.
Yes.
I mean, when in our working lives do we not have a deadline? And I think with writing, because it's often people trying to get into writing have other jobs and it's kind of a hobby that they want to make not a hobby. And so they do it with their evenings. They may even be disciplined enough to write for an hour a day. But a piece of art is never finished, right? And so you can just tinker around with the introduction for 6 or 8 months and then you've literally got nowhere. Whereas if on the other hand you say, right, I'm going to write a book, 4 months.
Yeah.
You've got to do it.
You've got to do it. But it has to be a meaningful deadline. If you keep thinking, oh, I can delay it a little bit longer. Yeah, I think a deadline really does help. That's a good idea.
And speaking of deadlines, if you go to emiratesliterfest.com, I just want to remind you that you can enter the Montegrappa Prize, which is open for submissions. You need to submit an opening chapter, 2,000 words of your opening chapter, and a 400-word synopsis. All the details are online, and you have the opportunity to have your work read by a top UK literary agent and some wonderful other prizes as well. So if you're looking for something to spur you on and a deadline, which is what we're talking about being really important, then that is something that could work for you. Jonathan, just very briefly, there's another competition. So if novel writing isn't your thing, there's something else that you can do, isn't there?
Yeah, so speaking of deadlines, the deadline for the 2018 BBC World Service Radio Playwriting Competition is the 31st of January 2018. Now, if you haven't started, this will be a tight one, but as we said, why not set yourself a challenge? So this is open to anyone age 18 or older and living outside the UK. So most of the people listening, I would imagine. You can be an established writer or a complete novice. And there are two main prizes, one for those with English as their first language and one for those with English as their second language. Again, that's going to be almost everybody who is listening. And the prize is a trip to London £2,200 sterling, and your play broadcast across the world on the BBC World Service. So Fortune and Glory.
So what's the deadline again for that?
It is the 31st of January 2018, and if you want to hear a little bit more about that, just go onto the BBC World Service website.
And remember, for the Montegrappa Prize, I've got the closing date in front of me, so you have until the 19th of January 2018, and emiratesLitFest.com is where you go for more details about that. Thank you so much, Flora, for coming on the show and talking about still.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.